You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 262, Exodus 3, part 2b. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how are you?
Pretty good. Can't complain, even though I might want to.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're finally getting to the watchers and the weirder stuff here about Exodus 3. We teased it. We split it up into two parts, so we made people wait an extra week, but I think it'll be worth it.
That was my fault. Just went too long on the other one, so we had a little bit of mercy.
No, that's okay.
We have to file it under mercy.
No, it helps us because, you know, on the weekends that, you know, we're gone or doing something, it helps us cover those weekends. So we had to do it, but, you know, another week to get into the watchers. It's worth it.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
All right. Well, I'm excited. What are we going to be talking about today?
It's basically going to focus on how a literate Israelite, again, somebody familiar with their Old Testament and with Second Temple Jewish texts, so a literate person living in that intertestamental period, how they would have thought about, you know, the connections in the Old Testament between Cain and the things that Cain's, you know, genealogy was known for, things like metallurgy is the obvious connection, but there are other ones, and how intertestamental literature linked that stuff, you know, that those marks of civilization, if we will, to the watchers. So somebody who's familiar with Second Temple material, like books like Enoch and then Old Testament, they're going to wonder, well, why in the world would the guy who wrote Enoch connect Cain to all this? Because aren't the Cainites good guys? I mean, they sort of preserve, you know, the knowledge of Yahweh or the name or the, you know, something like that. I mean, there's something good going on there with the Cainites. You know, Moses marries into that group. So why this negative connection? How would they have, you know, perhaps thought about what the writers were doing? For this, we need to go back to the genealogy of Cain and the Cainites. Okay. And I'm going to refer to an article. I will put this in the protected folder again. There's an article online. Actually, I wouldn't have to here because this you can actually find online by Philip Esler, Esler. The title of the article is Deus Victor, The Nature and Defeat of Evil in the Book of the Watchers. Now, that is a chapter from a book called The Blessing of Enoch, First Enoch in Contemporary Theology. It's published by Wiffenstock. And this particular chapter of it is pages 166 through 190. So Esler, again, I just read you the subtitle, The Nature and Defeat of Evil in the Book of the Watchers. When he's talking about how the Book of the Watchers, which within the Book of Enoch, the Book of the Watchers is chapters 1 through 36, how that material sort of frames the problem of evil, where it comes from and, you know, God's victory over it. In the course of those chapters of Enoch, Cain is a player, okay, and this how the writer of First Enoch sort of deals with Cain is interesting. It's instructive here. And once we sort of see this, we have to wonder if the writer of First Enoch, he would have known biblically about the connection to the Cainites, okay? He would have known that because it's transparently in Scripture. And for us, it gives us some real interesting things to think about. Because here's the question. If the Cainites are sort of good guys, you know, they preserve the worship of Yahweh. Let's just say that. Or they know who Yahweh is. If they're sort of good guys, why in the world would the Bible connect them with a guy as bad as Cain? You say, well, it's because they were metalsmiths. Yeah, I get that. But then if you know the Book of the Watchers material, again, think like a first century Jew here. Let's say you know all this material. You're sitting there thinking, oh, I get that metalsmith thing, but you know, isn't that one of the things that the Watchers, you know, get blamed for teaching humankind because it led to self-destruction? So if they're good guys, why do that? Why would the Bible writer do that? Good question. So Esler on page 4 writes this. To appreciate the nature of evil in the Book of the Watchers in a manner that is sensitive to the structure of the work, it is useful to draw a distinction between dramatic time and narrative time. Here, dramatic time refers to the time during which the plot of the work involving the secession of the Watchers from heaven and the description of First Enoch's activities takes place. Narrative time, on the other hand, means the much larger sweep of time that embraces all of the events referred to in the drama of the Watchers and Enoch, which actually extend from the creation to the period of the final judgment and beyond. I mean, Enoch runs the scope from creation to, you know, the second earth. I mean, it runs the gamut. Esler adds, it should be noted that the text does not always describe events in strictly chronological order. Thus, the Watchers descend to earth in 1 Enoch 6, loose again, based on Genesis 6, 1 through 4. But it is not until 1 Enoch 12 that we hear that, quote, before these things, unquote, Enoch was taken, i.e. to heaven, which relates to an earlier period, Genesis 5, 24, which is obviously before Genesis 6. This is one of the several signs in the text that the author well understands the broad chronological course of universal and Israelite history, even though he is capable of jumping from one time to the other. On pages 10 to 11, Esler writes, Cain must be understood as the prototypical evildoer on the earth, the first person to engage in what for the Enochic scribe is the worst kind of evil, acts of violence. In the case of Cain, and by necessary implication, others after him, homicidal violence. Abel is the first of many to petition heaven on account of this murder. Pages 13 and 14, Esler adds, the next evil in chronological order, you know, after the Cain incident, is that of the Watchers desiring women and wanting to beget children from them, 1 Enoch 6:2. Their leader recognizes this as a great sin. So even the leader of the Watchers, you know, if you actually read Enoch, he admits this is a great sin. When the Watchers do this, they are said to, quote, defile themselves, unquote. The Watchers also, as the story goes on, impart knowledge to human beings. And then Esler goes on to, you know, rabbit trail on that. You know, one of those false teachings was metallurgy, specifically fashioning weapons for war and bloodshed. That was one, you know, way that evil would proliferate in the world and destroy the image, destroy the imagers. You destroy humans, the imagers of God. Esler continues after he talks about the false teaching there. But the true horror of the Watchers' secession from heaven emerges only afterward in the actions of their progeny, the giants to which their wives give birth, 1 Enoch 7, 4, and 5. The core of the evil they produce is violence, to the extent of killing and then eating human beings, the creatures of the earth, and even themselves, you know, cannibalism. Thus, violence, initiated by Cain, reappears in a most extreme form with the giants. Now, that's the end of Esler's selections, at least right now. But let's think about this for a moment. In 1 Enoch, Book of the Watchers, that material creates a conceptual link between Cain and the Watchers. The Watchers' crimes, which are various, reach a crescendo in the violence that ensues from their activity. Now, here's the question. Is there any indication biblical writers might have been tracking along the same lines, that is, connecting, thinking of Cain as some sort of prototypical bad guy, a murderer, and then connecting them with the giants, connecting Cain with the giants, connecting murder, you know, with all that kind of stuff. So is there any evidence biblically that they might have been sort of thinking, biblical writers might have been tracking with this? Like if a biblical writer was here, you know, Moses or whoever of the Torah, and I read him what I just read, would he say, oh yeah, you know, we know that. We get it. Is there any evidence for that? Well, let's think about that. In the Old Testament, Cain's murder in Genesis 4 is, of course, famous, but who's the next murderer? Okay, ask yourself the question, who's the next murderer? It's Lamech. That's also in Genesis 4, 17 through 24, where we read, Cain knew his wife. This is verse 17, Genesis 4. She conceived and bore Enoch. When he built a city, he called the name of the city after the name of his son Enoch. Now, I'm going to insert a note here. This is not the same Enoch as in Genesis 5, the one that goes to heaven, okay? That one in Genesis 5 is the seventh from Adam, according to the New Testament and Second Temple literature. Cain's son is obviously not the seventh from Adam in the biblical story, okay? So on to verse 18. To Enoch was born Irad, and Irad fathered Mehujael, and Mehuyael fathered Methushael, and Methushael fathered Lamech. And Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Adah, the name of the other was Zillah. Adah bore Jabal in most English Bibles. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah also bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. And Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Now, some observations here. First, Lamech is a descendant of Cain. Second, Lamech is a murderer like his forefather, and he even references Cain's crime as some sort of badge of honor. Third, one of the sons of Lamech is Tubal-Cain, the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron. Another son was, quote, father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. In other words, people just like the Midianites. HBD, referencing that again, notes, Tubal-Cain is known as a forger of all implements of copper and iron. As descendants of the fugitive wanderer Cain, Tubal-Cain and his relatives, and later the Kenites, typify nomadic tradesmen associated with the rise of urban life and commerce and with the sin and violence it occasioned. That's the end of the HBD quote. Lamech also had another son in chapter 5. See, he has these three sons in chapter 4. Okay, we've got Jubal, Tubal-Cain. But he has another son in Genesis 5, 28. Remember who that was? Noah. And so here we go. Here we go with the how do you get Nephilim after the flood question again. Because later on, we're going to have the giants. I mean, think of Enoch now. Enoch, the writer of 1 Enoch, links the violence of the giants with Cain. Just point blank, it does that. And we've asked the question, well, would biblical writers make those connections? Well, Cain is the prototypical murderer. You've got Lamech next. One of Lamech's sons is Noah. And after, you know, we know what happens with Noah and the sons of God, and they have giants. The giants, you know, well, here we go. Even though the biblical story doesn't have the cannibalism and all that kind of stuff, it does say that the giants were lethal enemies of the people of God. So I'm not saying that this is the best way to look at Genesis 6 and the Nephilim and all that stuff. I'm not saying it's the best view. I'm just saying that you can see the logic. If someone either in antiquity or today wants to create a genealogical line back to Cain, to the giants after the flood, you could actually do that because Noah is a descendant of Lamech who is a descendant of Cain. You could actually make that argument. I know a lot of people listening out here, well, Noah was pure in all his generations. Well, and if you actually do a word study on that, it's not the normal word for lineal descendants. You know, this word dor is used of generations as in the people living at your same time, like the generation of the 60s, that kind of thing. Doesn't mean they're all related. It just means they're alive at the same time. Now, in fairness, that word is used one time, in my knowledge, for lineal descent. So I guess it's possible. But one time versus a few dozen other times where it's never used that way or it's not used that way, the odds are against you. And in fact, this is why in antiquity you had some Second Temple Jews gravitate toward someone in Noah's lineage sort of being responsible for the survival in terms of genealogy, the survival of the giants after the flood. This is why they went there. And if you do that, and I'm not saying the writer of 1 Enoch did, he doesn't spell that out. Again, we don't want to overstate the data here. But he does connect them, at least conceptually. Frankly, I think that's the better way to connect them, these conceptual connections. But anyway, I just want to make the comment here that if this was your predilection, you know, to come up with some like real, you know, biological genealogy, that's your explanation for giants after the flood. And now we've got Noah and Lamech and Cain, and that's the way the writer of Enoch saw it. Well, okay, you know, he may well have seen it that way. Doesn't mean it's right. Just it's a workable thing. You know, at least on a textual basis. Now, again, if that's the way you want to go, you know, you'd have it. Now, this takes us into the genealogies of Genesis 4. And I'm telling you, I know the genealogies are boring, but there's some crazy stuff in the genealogies. If you understand how they people were thinking about them. And I'm gonna give you a quote here from Wenham's Genesis commentary on Genesis 4 here. He's writing about that genealogy that we just read, the one that has Cain and Lamech, okay? He says, here the genealogical structure of the account becomes apparent again. Verse 17 could have immediately followed verse 2 had not the long digression about Abel's murder been included at that point. Verses 17 through 24 include several brief comments on the vocations of Cain's descendants, but only the only lengthy digression is the Song of Lamech, in which he shows that he has all the violent traits of his forefather. It may be noted that these comments cluster around Enoch and Lamech. The only two men in this genealogy whose names reappear in the genealogy of Adam via Seth, which is interesting. We'll get to that in a moment. Apparently, to make sure that the two Enochs and the two Lamechs are not confused, both genealogies give more detail about these individuals than the others in these lists. For the most part, the other antediluvians remain simply names. The general similarity of the style with the rest of chapter 4 persuades most commentators that, again, we have, without getting into all of Wenham's discussion here, that we've got two separate genealogies. He says, parallels with the Sumerian flood story have already been mentioned, again, earlier in his commentary. Mesopotamian sources make occasional mention of seven Apkallus who lived before the flood. The older texts are not explicit about the precise skills of these Apkallus, but the oldest Apkallu is called Adapa and is associated with Eridu, generally regarded in Mesopotamian tradition as the first city to be founded. Remember the first city in the genealogy, Irad, Eridu, pretty much the same. Okay, so now we're getting into the Apkallu first city traditions in the genealogical line in Genesis 4. Again, you have to think like an Israelite or like a Jewish reader. What were the thoughts they would have been thinking when they read this stuff? Again, if you're a literate Jew, like these scribes were, they're seeing these sorts of connections. Now, Wenham goes on, he says here, he quotes R.R. Wilson, who has a very sort of well-known book on genealogy and history in the biblical world. It's out of print, but you can still get it used on Amazon. Wenham says this, the parallels between Genesis 4, 17 through 26 and extra-biblical traditions are not close enough to suggest direct borrowing by Genesis from the extant sources. It's possible, though, that the biblical writer knew these old ideas and wanted to comment on them. He held that technology was a human achievement, not the gift of the gods. Indeed, by linking urbanization and nomadism, music and metalworking to the genealogy of Cain, he seems to be suggesting that all aspects of human culture are in some way tainted by Cain's sin. Now he quotes Wilson. By virtue of being Cain's descendants, the people named in the genealogy all inherit his curse. Thus, the Cainite genealogy becomes part of the Yahwist's account of man's increasing sin, unquote. You know, again, these are conceptual connections. So if you don't prefer now I've got sort of an argument to make for a literal genealogy back to Cain, you know, through the Watchers and the Giant, all that stuff. If that's not your cup of tea, then how else could we think about this? And again, this is sort of where I'm angling for. This is where I'm at. I think that the material or thinking about the material becomes more coherent, it makes more sense. At least it's more textually defensible. If we think conceptually, and that is, follow me here. Cain is the prototypical murderer. Again, we're thinking like a Jew about what we're reading in Enoch and what we know from the Old Testament. And the interface there is Cain. Okay, Cain is the prototypical murderer, the archetypal human agent of chaos after Adam and Eve are driven from Eden. Sure, Adam and Eve fell. They sinned. But Enoch and other Second Temple texts don't have them as the reason for depravity. I've talked about this before on the podcast. That depravity they assign to the Watchers. What the Watchers did is cast as the catalyst for human self-destruction. Cain foreshadows human self-destruction. He typifies the havoc the Watchers and their spawn, the giants, from whom would come demons, would wreak on Earth. by means of their false teaching, which spread idolatry and, of course, violence. And so these elements, Cain, Watchers, Giants, are conceptually and textually connected, even without throwing a literal genealogy into the mix. Maybe a better question to ask is, and here's the relevance to our episode, why the Cainites are made part of this in the Bible? Aren't they good guys? Sure, they descend from the non-elect line of Abraham, Esau, but they still worship the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham. God brings Moses to them to reintroduce himself to Moses, or maybe for the first time. Again, we'll talk about that next week. Why taint the Cainites with Cain? After all, if the Torah was edited during the exile at some point, why would an editor both telegraph the good guy stuff and the, hey, you guys are part of Cain's line stuff? It just doesn't seem to go together. But we have to ask ourselves if we're in fact reading the association with Cain the right way, or whether we're seeing the correct rationale behind the association. Does the biblical writer connect the Cainites to Cain to villainize the Cainites, or is there some other reason that he might be doing it? I would suggest there is another reason, one that you can communicate with one word, and that is reversal. So let's rethink what we've been talking about, starting with the boring genealogies. And on the episode page, I have a map, or not a map, but I have a graphic, a picture of the genealogies in Genesis 4 and 5. So, you know, if you're listening to the episode now and you don't have it, you know, just know that you can go back and look at it. But there's three columns in this picture. There's the genealogy on the left-hand side from Genesis 5. It starts with Adam and it ends with Noah through Lamech. Then in the middle, there's Genesis 4, which is the real short fragmentary Sethite line, Adam, Seth, and Enosh. And then on the right-hand column, there's Genesis 4, which begins with Adam and doesn't end with Noah. It ends with Yuval, Yuval, Tubal Cain through Lamech. Okay? So have a look at that, and maybe you want to re-listen to this, but if you look at the picture, the genealogies actually telegraph some things. And you can add this to the dumpster of stuff you never hear in church. You know, it's basically all we do here, but here we go again. So if you're thinking about the genealogies, Wenham writes this: the three-member genealogy of Seth, that's the middle one, in Genesis 4, 25, and 26, acts as a trailer to the full 10-member genealogy of chapter 5. It has also been observed that the last seven members of the Sethite genealogy in chapter 5 parallel the genealogy of Cain in chapter 4, Genesis 4, 17, and 18. To be precise, Wenham says, of the six names mentioned in Genesis 4, 17, and 18, two, Enoch and Lamech, reappear in Genesis 5, 12 through 28. And only Lamech appears at the same point in the genealogy as its penultimate, its next to last member. If, however, again, Mahalalel changes place with Enoch in chapter 5, you know, he says you can line these up just by place name. Doesn't mean they're the same person, but the same place names. Or not place names, the same personal names, if you just flip a few around. They're all kind of there, just different order. But again, doesn't necessarily mean that they're the same people. Except for, you know, Lamech, you know, again, and his kids. That's the interesting point. Now, Wilson, again, that quote where Wenham had quoted Wilson, has pointed out, Wenham says, that peoples often retain variant genealogies alongside each other without sensing any contradiction between them. Certainly, the editor of Genesis did not regard these genealogies as identical or completely identical. Not only do they have different starting points, Cain and Seth, and different conclusions, Tubal Cain and Noah, but Enoch and Lamech, the only identical names within the two genealogies, are distinguished by additional biographical details, which show that they were, again, very likely regarded as different people. The morphological similarity of the other names would be explained by, you know, grammatical stuff, assimilation. That's what he's talking about here. He says, comparing the genealogies in the present setting in Genesis indicates the editor saw them as distinct. The different styles suggest they probably derive from distinct sources. But this is not to say that they must have first been brought together by an editor, for once again, the Sumerian flood story may have discussed similar topics. Again, so when he talks about topics here, he's getting into this idea that the names in the genealogies, even if they're different, the names convey certain things, certain concepts, certain topics in the flow of primeval history. I would suggest to you something. If you look at the genealogies, here's what's interesting. Just look at them side by side. The left-hand line, you have the good guy. The left-hand column, you have the good guy line. Adam to Noah incorporating Seth. Of course, Seth replaced Abel because Abel was killed. It's a good guy line because it leads to a deliverer. God calls in the days of the flood, Noah. God will preserve humanity through this line. Maybe we should call it the God's plan line. Genesis 4 on the right-hand column is the chaos line, the bad guy line. It doesn't include Seth. It skips from Adam to Cain on up to Lamech, okay, Noah's father in the other genealogy. But instead of having Noah as Lamech's son, who do we get? Yuval, Yuval, and Tubal-Cain. Tents and livestock, lyre and pipe players, and then the metalworking thing. Big deal, you say. Well, it is kind of a big deal when you realize that those things, dwelling in tents, having livestock, dwelling in cities, that's also in chapter 5 in the genealogical section. It's also in chapter 4 in the bad guy line. Yeah, that's how I want to say it. It's also in chapter 4 when after Cain, you know, has to leave, he builds a city. Or somebody builds a city. That's a subject for another episode. But the building of the city is also in the bad guy line. All of those things, the formation of civilization, the fashioning of weapons, metallurgy, all that stuff that's interested here, and music is part of, what civilization broadly encompasses. All of those things are the stock elements of the Prometheus myth from classical Greece. Remember Prometheus, the titan, one of the titans that gives this knowledge, to human beings. And it, of course, it's not viewed as a good thing. They are all elements of settled civilization. So there are actually some scholars, again, this is a rabbit trail we won't take, that wonder if the Prometheus story actually borrows or reflects some of the older biblical and ancient Near Eastern material about civilization, how we get civilization. Either the Watchers, the Apkallu, or something like that. But these are the elements of the Prometheus story, which is really kind of interesting. What you have here is you have the good guy line, the line of the plan of God, being set against the line that produces not only depravity and murder and chaos, but also civilization. You say, well, why would that be bad? Why would those things be connected? Think about what it means to pit the genealogies against one another. And then loop the Cainites into this. Think reversal. The good guy line marks the line God will use to reverse the bad guy line, the chaos line. In fact, if the Torah links the Midianites back to Cain, it's a bit interesting that those Cainites or Midianites will wind up in territory associated with the non-elect line of Abraham, the Edomites, Esau. The Edomites and Cainites, both on the outs with God's plan, as it were, wind up in the same area. And it is to that area that God directs Moses to confront him with his mission of not only delivering Jacob's line from Egypt, but of rejoining the family strands back together. Remember, Moses marries into the Midianite line. And plenty of Midianites join the ranks with Israel. God, of course, has been trying to bring the two lines back together and blunt the power of depravity for a long time before we get to Moses. He's been trying to, again, restore the nations. I mean, God called Abraham out of paganism. He divorced the nations, but not so that the nations would be forever excluded from his family. God made a covenant with Abram that through his seed, all nations would be blessed. And those nations include places that would later become known as Midian and Edom. They're actually in Genesis 10. They're included in Canaan as a whole place, plus Aram, Uz, and Hul, descendants of Shem, the Semites. Okay, these places are included. They're just not called Midian and Edom yet. Genesis 10's promise even includes the land of a city builder and civilizer, Nimrod. Babylon is not exempt from redemption in God's overall picture. The covenant is a compassionate one. Later, the angel of Yahweh wrestles with Jacob on the eve of his reunion with Esau. It's through Moses, of course, that God gives the law, quote, added because of transgressions, unquote, Galatians 3:19. To restrain human evil until the Messiah would come, die, rise again, and ascend, triggering the coming of the Spirit, the primary agent in believers to reverse depravity, which was in turn laid out at the feet of the Watchers, or laid at the feet of the Watchers in Second Temple Judaism. And when we get to Exodus, God sends Moses into the land of the prodigal line, where God has been present through, though largely unnoticed, for a very long time. It's time to call a man, Moses, whose life's ministry will work to reverse the chaos of the world through the promised plan line of Jacob, the Israelites, whose descendants are supposed to be a kingdom of priests, and through whom the ultimate reverser, the Messiah, will come, and of course, the reclaiming of the nations. We even get a foreshadowing of all this. Again, just to summarize all that, if you think about when you pit the line that the good guy line, the line of deliverance, okay, Noah. I mean, we could throw in a whole, we could throw in the, right here, the fact that in Jewish tradition, as I've talked about, you know, with Revelation 12, the birth of the Messiah, Jewish tradition had Noah and the one born on, you know, September 11, 3 BC, Tishri 1. Jesus and Noah would have shared a birthday. Again, just using, you know, Jewish tradition in that. So you have this deliverance line. It's set over against the line of chaos. And the line of chaos actually works its way into biblical history, and the lines converge in the Moses story. The non-elect line of Abraham is there. The Midianites, the Kenites are there. The ones who, you know, who are linked back to Cain, you know, this awful guy, Cain, they're, you know, symbols of chaos. You know, why is civilization, why is urbanization, why is human technology and invention viewed as a bad thing, just generally? Because it's not Edenic. It's of human origin. Everything of human origin is less than Eden in biblical thinking. Now, it can be used for good. It can be used for self-destruction. And of course, in the Enochian mind, it's the watchers that give this to humanity deliberately, intentionally, to encourage the destruction of the image of God, the imagers of God, human beings. So on the one hand, yes, technology, civilization, it's neutral in terms of the way it's used. But in the course of the big picture of the biblical story, it was viewed negatively. It was viewed, again, as something un-Eden, anti-Eden, less than Eden. It just reflects life, not, you know, it's sort of like it's putting in human hands the restoration of Eden. And that is not God's plan. God's plan is to restore Eden through a single person, okay, the Messiah, Christ, the seed of Abraham, who, again, will unite all nations. And he will unite the disparate strands of Abraham's own family, his genealogy. There's God's method for restoring paradise, restoring utopia, restoring Eden. And then there's everything else. And everything else is of human origin. This is what's working through the mind of the biblical writer, you know, of the Enochian writer. This is how they're thinking about their world and about the whole situation of the world. We have lost Eden. We cannot restore it ourselves. Any attempt to restore it ourselves is going to fail. And in fact, we now, with as we learn, as we build, as we do things, you know, we are dependent on our own devices. And if, you know, left to ourselves in a non-Edenic world, humanity will turn these things against humanity. I mean, this is our world today. This is our world today. These categories of thought should not be unfamiliar. Everything that humans set their hand to is a two-edged sword. Everything. It's either brought into captivity, you know, to the Lord, or it's not. So they're thinking along these same lines, but they're communicating the ideas through genealogy, you know, through the violence, you know, of you know, the Watchers, through Genesis 6, through books like Enoch. Even again, just the simple concept of civilization. It's less than Eden because we're doing it, because God is not doing it. You know, only when God is at the helm can Eden be restored the way it should be. That is the only path, the power of God is the only path to restore things as they should be, as God originally wanted them. So they're trying to communicate these ideas through, you know, really, again, to us, strange means. These episodes, these stories, you know, genealogies. It's just interesting that when you get to Moses and you get the Kenites, if you're a literate Jew, you know about the Kenites. They're from Cain. Isn't it kind of ironic? Isn't it, you know, irony? It's a reversal, okay? Isn't it interesting that God would have Moses go to the place where these descendants are, and that God would use them in some way to save Moses' life, and Moses would become the deliverer. Okay, through him, the knowledge of Yahweh would either be restored or would proliferate itself through this man Moses that the Kenites, the Midianites, are instrumental in saving and preserving, you know, this guy. God is using the unfavored line to do what he wants to do. He is using those who, again, have just fallen by the wayside to accomplish his plan. I mean, it's really a significant theological lesson. And the more you dig down into it, again, you see the ironic reversal of this. And we even get it telegraphed, like in Messianic prophecy. I'll end with this. You know, we get a foreshadowing of this. If you're into the birth narratives of Jesus, I would recommend Father Raymond Brown's book. Raymond Brown was a famous New Testament scholar. He's deceased now. He wrote some massive stuff on the Gospels, and he wrote a really huge book, a thick book, on the birth narratives of Jesus. But he writes this. He says, the gold and frankincense gifts bestowed upon Jesus and his family derive from Isaiah 60, verse 6, and Psalm 72, 15. Those items, gold and frankincense specifically, are associated with the desert camel trains coming from Midian, you know, in northwest Arabia, and from Sheba, the kingdom of the Sabaeans in southwest Arabia. You could add Jeremiah 6:20 to that mix as well. This is me talking now. What about the myrrh? Remember the Ishmaelite, Midianite traders from the Joseph story? Okay, let's read Genesis 37:25 and following. And you're going to hear something interesting here. Genesis 37:25. They sat down to eat, Joseph's brothers, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites, ironic, coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Okay. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites. And let not our hands be upon him, for he's our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. By the way, Judah says that. Judah winds up, you know, saving his life. Judah, you know, that tribe from which the Messiah would come. His brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by. And they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Again, I think, back to Vandertorn, I think it's entirely possible that the name of Yahweh does go to Egypt through Joseph. And it comes back and forth. You know, there's going to, you got these traders, you got Semites running around all over the place. Again, I think what Vandertorn says is really worth considering. I don't know that it solves anything, but it's worth considering. You know, and here you have all the elements. You have all of the elements. You know, in Jesus' day, where does myrrh come from especially? It comes from the Nabataeans. There's an Anchor Bible Dictionary article, the Nabataeans. You'll get this. They're from South Arabia. You know, it's the same thing as in these other two references. My overall point, again, in the foray to wrap this up, is the guy who wrote First Enoch, a Second Temple Jew, saw the genealogies, again, pitted against each other, God's plan versus chaos. And he saw Cain as a prototypical murderer, the archetypal human agent of chaos. And so that author aligned Cain with the Watchers and the harm they did. New Testament kind of does something similar in 1 John 3 when it links Cain to Satan. My view is that these are conceptual, not literary links, though. And ultimately, the teaching point is that the chaos genealogy expresses the idea that human civilization is invariably anti-Eden or less than Eden. It's human, as opposed to what could have been. So it's a biblical theological rationale that, in my mind, tells us why utopia always fails. Nothing we can do measures up to Eden. We can't recreate it on our own terms. We can't reverse Babel through our own plans and our own tactics on the way to building our own Eden. Only God can do this. And he inaugurated his own remedy through Christ, who fulfills the law of Moses and the covenants and is the key to uniting all the lines of Abraham and the nations. So, I mean, this is big picture archetypal thinking. And the reason I wanted to include the Enoch stuff in here is there's just stuff lurking around in the Bible that if you read later texts, like Second Temple Jewish literature, they are tracking on ideas that wouldn't normally occur to you. But they're, when you go back, when you listen to their idea, and then you go back into the Old Testament, you think, oh yeah, okay, I see where you could get that. I see why you could connect those dots the way you did. It's just instructive. It's just another way to think about the material. And frankly, we've all wondered, what in the world is Genesis 4 doing in the Old Testament anyway? The whole Cain story seems kind of interruptive. He is an agent of chaos. Lamech is an agent of chaos. You know, what Cain does, even the building of the city, points to the futility. Okay, because Cain does it. The futility of trying to restore order and Eden. Only God can do these things. And again, it's big picture level thinking, but I think, again, for our purposes, it just gets us into it a little bit so that we can understand how people of Jesus' day, again, Second Temple period, how they would have been thinking about their material, their Bible. And in this case, it sort of leeches out to us through a book like First Enoch.
We're going to have to listen to this episode several times, Mike. It's a lot to unpack.
It is.
All right, Mike. We've got part three coming next week. And I want to remind our listeners, please, if you are an iTunes listener, go, 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 go. Rate us, even give us a review if you could take time. Please do that. Every single one of you that listens to us through iTunes, please do that and help other people discover us. All right, Mike, we'll look forward to part three next week, finally wrapping up chapter three.
So I promise.
Well, with that, we want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.